Hi, this is Arno. Welcome to the channel. Today we have Jameson with us. Jameson is one of the most influential people in the crypto space, and he writes great blogs. He has a very active Twitter page, and he is involved in the community for a long time. And today we are going to talk to him more about how he views the current crypto system and what are his views on some interesting topics like Lightning, fund security, and so on and so forth. So thanks, Jameson, first of all, for accepting our invitation to come on the call.
My pleasure. Happy to be here.
Awesome. So can you start off by talking about what are some projects that you're working on currently? And where are you spending your most of the time in crypto currently?
Well, my full-time job is currently at Casa, overseeing the infrastructure and general security model, design of what we're building with our premium product, which is this non-custodial multi-sig vault. Then we also have another product that we announced, did a pre-sale for, and we'll start shipping in a week or so, which is the Bitcoin full node / Lightning node product. That is kind of coming in on the exact opposite end of the market, really targeting more of the lower end enthusiasts who would be willing to spend a few hundred dollars to get into that part of the ecosystem, whereas our high end product is more for the crypto multimillionaire who's basically $10,000 a year to get an extremely high level of support and a user-friendly high security solution for vaulting their large amount of Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Can you talk about how you actually got into crypto and why, how did you start with Casa as well?
It's been a pretty long journey. Originally got interested in 2012 just from reading Slashdot articles about it and realizing that the system was not falling apart and failing as I had expected that it would. So I started looking into it, reading the white paper, looking at some of the code, and just trying to sift through Bitcoin talk forum posts and keep track of what was happening on Reddit and other social media. And within, I guess it was about a year and a half later, I forked Bitcoin Core myself and created Satoshi, where I was basically trying to bring more transparency into the operations that were happening inside of a Bitcoin node, because I wanted to understand it better. And I felt like there was probably some use for other developers to understand it as well. Then put a nice dashboard on top of that and made Satoshi.info a public dashboard where anybody can go in and kind of get a better understanding of what's happening on the network and what's happening inside of my node. And it's all open source, so if anyone wants to, they can basically replicate that themselves and run their own Satoshi node. And then about a year after I did Satoshi, that's when I guess there was another price run up. That was $1,000 run up, in 2014. And I just saw a lot of venture capital coming into the space and figured that I could probably get a full-time job. And that's when I joined BitGo in early 2015, basically spent 3 years there running a lot of their infrastructure, both the node operations and then various indexing operations to create databases that the wallet platform could then talk to figure out, what is the current state of the blockchain. And then at the beginning of this year, pivoted slightly, and I'm still doing infrastructure for multi-sig, non-custodial crypto products, but instead of having an enterprise focus where BitGo was really doing hot wallet stuff and helping exchanges and transaction processors, instead we're really focusing on the individuals at Casa, and we think there was a gap in the market there. So just trying to make it easier for people who have they have come into a large amount of wealth that they never anticipated because they've been in the space for a few years and the value has gone up so much. And now I think there's a lot of people who are in a position where they're just like afraid, you know, they don't want to screw up. They don't want to lose all their money because they know that if you screw up, it's gone and nobody can help you. So we're just trying to offer a product that can give people a peace of mind.
Makes sense. And, since crypto is like super nascent right now, and like people say we are still in the 1995 of crypto, right? Even individuals like us who are techies and like we try to figure our way out on like how to store our private key and like how to make our phone secure and stuff like that. How far do you think we are from like a normal user being able to use crypto? It might be a wallet or like running their own node, because this is still like super early and like only for the geeks.
Oh yeah. You know, definitely many years. You know, the problem right now is that even though it's possible to be your own bank and do this all yourself, even the really sophisticated technical people who have been in the space for years, and this is part of the reason why I joined Casa, even if you have all of the knowledge, which can take years to gain, it's still a big time, component of what you have to dedicate to do it right. And so what I was seeing myself, I was just like creating a calendar event where like, on an annual basis, I go through all of my cold storage and like refresh it and, you know, make sure all the private keys are backed up, make sure recovery process works. And like doing all of that to like, quote unquote, do it right, was taking 1 to 2 days. So basically like a whole weekend. And, you know, I don't want to have to throw away an entire weekend every year, just to get a little more peace of mind. And I was figuring, you know, if it takes me that long, then I suspect the vast majority of people will just look at it and throw up their hands and say, you know, I'm not even going to bother with all of this. So that's why I think there is a big gap there that we can fill. And I'm pretty happy with what we've done so far at Casa, where you can actually get set up and onboarded with your multi-sig, multi-device wallet with Casa in like 5 or 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. And it's really, what we've done is we've brought in the usability of what you get with a mobile app. Mm-hmm. But instead of, you know, keeping all the private keys on your phone, we're then leveraging the security aspects of what you get with the hardware key management devices like the Trezors, Ledgers, Keys, Polling Cards, what have you. And kind of by like having a product that uses all of these different features and functionality, we can actually guide the user through the best practices. So, you know, instead of like throwing a security book at them or a, you know, IT data management handbook at them, we actually build the product in a way such that in order to use the product, you have to be following best practices. And I think that that is going to be the key for mainstream adoption, is that instead of relying upon users to educate themselves, which only nerds are going to educate themselves about how to do stuff right, you have to build the product in a way that does the education, you know, as they're using the product.
Right. Unlike companies like Google, who try to like get access to all of your data and like not serve the customer at all. Makes sense.
Yeah. And that's a hard thing to do, where, you know, even this is something we talk about a lot at Casa. We didn't talk about as much at BitGo, but mm-hmm. even when you're creating a like non-custodial service where, you know, we've already got a really solid foundation because we don't have private keys that can be stolen from us. So we're already like pushing the security out to the edges of our users. Mm-hmm. It still becomes a privacy issue of, you know, whenever you're interacting with a third party, you are giving them some data, and then that data could potentially be leaked and used against you. So, you know, right. we try to do as much as we can to minimize like even the amount of, you know, personally identifiable information and in logging and other stuff that we do in our own system. And that makes it more difficult for us, because when you're developing web applications, one thing that not many people think about is that a lot of the developer tools and debugging stuff and analytics and whatnot that are very useful for software developers, it's actually surveillance software. You're surveilling your users in order to better understand like when a crash happens or they hit an edge case and something goes wrong. And we don't want to surveil our users, but we do want to be able to help them and, you know, debug stuff. So it's a really, it's a whole other issue that we try to find this delicate balance around.
Right. Makes sense. And so this is just like one of the techniques of storing your funds safely, right? Multisig. But what do you foresee, like in the future, what other methods or what other strategies can an individual use, to keep their funds safe?
Yeah. So, you know, one standard thing that a lot of people have talked about, of course, is just various types of metal backup, like seed storage stuff. I actually did a stress test a few months ago where I bought a lot of the common metal seed phrase storage devices and put them through the ringer. You know, I think that a lot of them work very well, and they will work very well for the vast majority of scenarios, like even a house fire or whatever. I put them through an extreme stress test just to figure out what the limits were. I think we will hopefully see new ways of kind of distributing the trust for this sensitive material. So even if you're not using multisig itself, like within one of these protocols, because actually a lot of them don't support multisig, then we may see kind of something that's similar to multisig, which is like a Shamir secret sharing, basically ways that you can split up the single sig or, you know, single key data in a way that you're distributing it around, you know, a set of friends and family that you are highly confident are not going to collude against you to steal all of your money. And, you know, this becomes important not just for redundancy of like natural disasters, fires, floods, what have you, but also for inheritance planning. And that's another big aspect of what we're doing at CASA, is that we think that while it is important to have really good security, both historically through various analyses that some analytics companies have done, and even anecdotally from what I've seen over the past 4 years working in space, it seems like you're far more likely to screw up and lose access to your keys than you are to have an attacker actually take control and steal your money.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But we need to help the user and keep them from shooting themselves in the foot, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just like to put it out there that we had bought like one of your CASA Lightning nodes, and like we personally follow CASA quite closely. And what I would like to like ask you is that all the current custody solutions, most of them are focusing on the enterprise and the institutions, and even like CASA is focusing on like high net worth individuals. Which sort of solution do you see? Like say Shamir Secret is one. Do you see that Shamir Secret or these sort of solutions would be used by say a normal person who has say $10,000 or $100,000 worth of crypto, and their wallet, their hot wallet, could be protected by such a recovery mechanism? And that system might be able to compete with the current say banking system.
Yeah. So. Once again, it's going to come down to how the user interface is designed. So, you know, when we talk about like Shamir secret sharing, unfortunately right now, if you want to do Shamir secret sharing, you're probably going to have to go find a command line tool, even some of the tools with UIs behind them that I've tried out, they're not even compatible with each other. It's like, they're generally not implementing it perfectly in a way that, you know, you can then use another tool later and be reasonably sure that you're going to be able to reconstitute the data. So we have Shamir secret sharing, which is this fundamental building block that I think we can build other stuff on top of. But that's the problem, is no one has really built good interfaces for using it. So, you know, it's going to end up needing to be another sort of software layer, you know, preferably within these wallets that says, okay, all you need to do now is go, you know, get your friends and family members and, you know, say, have them like, you know, NFC, you know, touch their wallet to your wallet, and, you know, do something that's just a dead simple, like impossible to screw up from the user standpoint in order to, you know, shard out that data. So, that's where really, I think all the work is going to come into, is how to abstract away all the complexities of that functionality and just provide the user a very like simple step-by-step guide for how to secure their own funds.
Yep. And I think like even multi-sig, like isn't that ideal? What's your thought on that? Like say if you want to do a lot of transactions in a day, multi-sig isn't ideal for that because you need to get like signatures from various places.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's what any security model, you have a trade-off between security and convenience. And so actually, we already do have a single sig functionality within the Casa wallet software. Mm-hmm. And so figure, you know, when you set up a Casa wallet, there's five keys. Casa has one offline. You keep one set of keys on your phone, and then you have three other dedicated hardware devices. And we were figuring that most likely someone is going to, you know, have those three devices geographically separated to make them secure against both physical attackers and against various disaster loss scenarios. But it would make sense for the user to carry around one device. And so that device could be a part of, you know, the three of five setup for the vault, but it could also be used as a single SIG wallet for their day-to-day spending. And so, you know, it is about, you know, supporting a variety of different security models, but doing so in a user-friendly fashion. So, you know, being able to reuse, you know, the same hardware device for multiple different types of wallet security models, I think helps bring down the complexity while still giving more convenience to the user.
Okay, makes sense. My next question is, there's like a ton going on in the space. We all know that 99% of the projects are shit coins, or like they barely do anything. They're just like marketing and like pure money fundraising kind of, you know, schemes going on. But having said that, there are also some really cool projects other than Bitcoin. Bitcoin obviously is the coolest, but there are projects like Monero, Decred, who are trying to do some really cool things like on layer one. And even inside Bitcoin, there are a lot of cool things going on, right? So there's like CoinJoin implementation that's coming, and then even stable coins, we have projects like Maker who are trying to like build decentralized kind of, you know, stable coins. So my question is, what are some of the things that you are really excited about in the space, and what should like a user or a high-end user inside crypto look towards, you know, to keep themselves updated?
So, you know, personally, I am most interested in privacy technologies and also scalability technologies. I mean, from a really high level of like getting crypto assets adopted, mainstream adoption, it needs to be attacked from many different fronts. And while scalability is one big issue, it's like if you don't have the usability, then it doesn't matter how much you can scale because nobody's going to use it. But if you get awesome usability and no scalability, then you get, you know, a bunch of adoption, and then you run into a wall and nobody else adopts it. And then, of course, there's also the, you know, privacy aspects as well, where while not everyone values their privacy so much in the long term, we've generally seen quite a few different instances where if you forego your privacy, you end up regretting it later. So as a result, you know, I'm interested in stuff like Mimblewimble, which is a, you know, completely novel take on doing both high security, high privacy, and high scalability. Last I checked, they are about to launch their final and fourth test network. So
that's Grincoin, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's Grin. You know, there's also Beam, and you know, Beam has like a different governance model. It seems to be more of a Zcash style governance model, whereas Grin seems to be more of a Bitcoin philosophy style governance, where you know they're going to do a fair launch with no pre-mine and no funny business. I think that it's going to be interesting because, you know, even a lot of the developers and contributors on there are anonymous, you know, kind of like Satoshi style. And, you know, we'll see how well that works. You know, the economics behind it are also kind of up in the air because they're doing this like unlimited emission schedule. But, you know, even if you're not that interested in the network itself, I think the technology is very interesting because, you know, anything that becomes interesting enough has the potential to, if not get actually subsumed by Bitcoin in the main protocol, by potentially getting like tacked on as a side chain, where it would be very easy to see some sort of Nimblewimble side chain to Bitcoin, where if you want the privacy of Nimblewimble, then you just, you know, lock up some of your Bitcoins and transfer them through a peg, and then do whatever you want much more anonymously on that side chain network.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, on a similar vein, Lightning Network also promises to have better privacy, though it's a lot more complex to reason about, and a lot of that is still up in the air as to how it'll work out. But I think that we're going to see this like explosion of innovation happen as second layers become more feasible. Mm-hmm. And that both, you know, through Lightning Networks and through side chains. And and you know, there's also the drive chain concept has been slowly progressing along. So if we can get to the point where it's easier for people or developers to create these side chains in a way that seems to be reasonably secure enough that people would then adopt them, then that just makes the pace of innovation, I think, go a lot faster. Because up until this point, if you wanted to innovate in this space, do something crazy that's not going to get, you know, adopted by an existing protocol, then you basically have to start an entire new network from scratch. And that's a really big challenge. You get into this like chicken and egg problem, you know, having to convince people to spend their resources to help you and you know, get adoption on various exchanges miners and like throughout the entire complex ecosystem. Whereas if you can just spool up a side chain that will hopefully be fairly standardized and easy for various ecosystem players to plug into, then we can start experimenting and not being as afraid of failing. Because, you know, if a side chain fails, then all you have to do is, you know, you can still peg your Bitcoins back. Like nobody's actually destroying money if it fails. It's not an economic experiment. It's more of just a technical experiment.
Right. Makes sense. And what do you think about a project? Although, like, I'm not trying to like have you judge various projects, but I'm personally also like super into like governance and like what the Decred project is trying to do on the base layer. So, do you have any mm-hmm. thoughts on whether governance is needed on layer one and like what Decred project has been up to? Do you think that has value in the long run?
It's an interesting thing. You know, some people care about governance and feel like they want to have a model that is easier to understand.
Mm-hmm.
And but you know what I think in any of these systems are about from a very fundamental standpoint is you know, voluntary interaction. And so if people want to opt into a certain governance model, then they have the freedom to do that. The weird thing that I have trouble kind of keeping a mental model around is, you know, if the governance is about making decisions that may be controversial, then I don't see how you can ever actually force anyone, you know, to accept a controversial decision that they don't want to. Because, you know, even in a system that has various governance mechanisms built into the technical layer, you can't stop people from forking, you know, create basically taking the software and forking off their own new network. So, you know, it may make sense for like more making like smaller decisions about certain things. I'm not sure whether or not there is a like technical solution for like major critical consensus decisions about the direction that any of these protocols are going to go in.
Okay, makes sense.
Okay, yep, that makes sense. And I want to move back to Lightning. So like this year, I think I watched one of your videos and heard you on the Noded podcast. You talked about like you are super excited about Lightning. So like, can you share like how do you have, what you have seen in Lightning, what sort of labs or what sort of work you have seen done by L&D, the C Lightning implementation and so on and so forth?
Yeah. So, you know, we've seen a lot of development happening at the actual like Lightning node software layer itself. You know, there've been a lot of bugs. A lot of people have found performance issues and fixed them. You know, as people and developers have been writing like the first wave of LAPS, and they've basically been, you know, stress testing the Lightning software itself and finding issues that need to be worked out, finding edge cases and bugs. And so, you know, it's kind of funny to see, you know, some people are like looking at the LAPS and saying, oh, these are all really, you know, stupid ideas, you know, this isn't changing the world. But, you know, it's really more proof of concept of just, you know, putting some transactional volume onto the Lightning network to try to, you know, stress it a bit more. And I think one of the things that's going to be more interesting about developers that are coming into these second layer networks is that they're, you know, not necessarily going to need as much guidance, I guess, as writing stuff on the first layer, where you know, to create a Bitcoin application actually requires setting up quite a bit of infrastructure.
Right.
You know, setting up the nodes, figuring out how to, you know, manage private keys and all of this stuff. But as we're building these other layers on top of Bitcoin, I think it's just becoming a more developer friendly experience. A good example of that is I guess Satoshi's Place, the Lightning Koala, who is the developer behind that, has said that, you know, he's just running that on a Raspberry Pi in his closet at home. And, you know, this is supporting, you know, thousands of users a day, you know, at its height, constantly, you know, redrawing this canvas and processing, I don't even know how many, like tens of thousands of transactions. And, you know, it wasn't a huge, you know, money making entrepreneurial venture for him. I think, you know, he probably made a few hundred dollars off of it. But it showed that, you know, this is a new type of business model that you can run.
Yep. And like in the sense of, say, wallets and exchanges, what sort of progress have you seen? And like even in Lightning, say a normal people start using Lightning wallets and they start doing Lightning transactions, how do you see that the nodes, what sort of companies or will run the nodes? And do you feel that even if, say, if we have 1 billion people who we have hyper Bitcoinization and we have 1 billion people using Bitcoin and they are transacting through Lightning, what sort of infrastructure do you see we'll have at that time?
Yeah, it's going, even to get to that level is going to require a lot more optimizations. And this is where I think we're seeing stuff that's happening, like with L2, for example, of trying to figure out how to do like mass channel management. Because of course, you know, the Lightning network is complicated, you know, it's Bitcoin plus a whole bunch of other stuff. And no one has ever really done anything like this before. So as we're stress testing these networks, we're finding various usability issues and economic issues. There was actually a good talk about the logic behind channel rebalancing recently at Scaling Bitcoin. We had a number of talks about how to manage channel opening and closing at a large scale. And I think that in general, what you're going to see is people writing software that is better able to manage multiple users of single channels, basically. I think that will be very critical for any of the large providers, whether it's exchanges or payment processors or what have you, rather than having to manage, tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of channels, being able to consolidate a lot of those users down into a smaller number of more manageable channels, which hopefully will then also be easier to manage, like from a liquidity and economic standpoint. But there's a lot of new things that people are playing around with, like the various like channel splicing stuff and the multi, what is it, the atomic multipath payment stuff, where essentially what this is all coming down to is figuring out kind of like a new economic model that we're having to deal with. It's a bit more complicated than just like on-chain Bitcoin transactions.
Okay, makes sense. So what do you feel about like possible flaws or any foreseeable events in the future that might try to bring the Bitcoin network down? It might be like a state level DDoS, or I don't know, there was like a bug recently, right? 17144. What in your mind, what do you see like some of the challenges are in front of us for the entire Bitcoin ecosystem to prevent it from a collateral damage kind of scenario?
There's also the question around like, is there any one thing or event that could sufficiently damage Bitcoin? I think it's not so much like what could be done to screw up the network from a technical standpoint, but more of what type of attack or failure could cause such a loss of confidence that it makes people stop wanting to invest in it, stop wanting to participate, stop wanting to dedicate their time and resources into making it a better network. And so that's why my general answer to like what is Bitcoin's greatest weakness or greatest threat is apathy. Is that if people stop caring and they stop trying to make it better and stop being willing to basically be at least for some of the developers be like operational on call, if there's an emergency you need to be ready to drop whatever is going on and fix the problem, because the longer that some sort of critical issue is out there and affecting people, the greater the confidence loss is going to happen. You can worry about various nation state level attacks. You can worry about various technical failures. I actually wrote extensively nearly 3 years ago about a number of adversarial conditions that might happen on Lightning Network and, different types of attacks. It would be more like economic attacks of like a wealth fund trying to push a lot of funds through the network in one direction to like try to imbalance many, many Lightning channels to the point that they're like forced to close, and then creating a lot of on-chain congestion as a result of that, which could then create kind of a vicious cycle due to the game theory and timeouts that are involved in channel closure. So I try to think less about like these specific things that might happen and more about the general awareness of, we just need to have a mindset within the community that this is an adversarial system, and we need to be willing to accept that it is not it's not perfectly robust that it can withstand any attack on its own, but rather it's anti-fragile because there are many of us out there who are remaining vigilant and are willing to step in and fix problems, you know, as they arise. So it's just, I think it's more of a mindset than anything else. I don't think that there's going to be any magic bullet that will make these systems like perfectly robust against all types of attacks.
Okay, well, then what do you think about mining centralization and like one company like Bitmain taking control of all the mining hash power? Although, I mean, all they can do is just double spend, right? If they do a 51%. But I'm hopeful about the fact that, like, I'm sure in the future there are going to be more companies. There are already companies like Obelisk and others who are developing ASIC miners. But do you see this monopoly breaking up in the future and not posing any threat?
Yeah, so, you know, it seems like, you know, Bitmain in particular has been running into a number of walls. It sounds like they haven't really been able to innovate that much on the hardware level. You know, I think that they've basically run into the threshold of what, like, our silicon processing technology can allow you to do. So I'm hopeful that from that perspective, it will be easier for other entrants to come into the market and compete with them. And you know, yeah, you know, mining centralization is definitely one of the bigger questions and threats to worry about. From a game theory perspective, like, I'm not worried about any of the large pools or Bitmain or whatever basically doing something to try to kill Bitcoin, because they basically be shooting themselves in the foot. But I would be more worried about what happens when another attacker, like a nation state, comes in and basically seizes a bunch of pools and equipment and then uses it to run attacks at very, very low cost because they have, you know, they can use their monopoly on violence basically to take over and run those attacks. But, you know, even in that scenario, it once again comes down to how resilient is the entire ecosystem to such an attack. And, you know, even if that type of almost doomsday scenario happened, it would be noticed within a few hours at the most. And then what we would see is a lot of people would be scrambling and coming together on various communications channels and saying, okay, you know, this is an existential threat. We need to do something about it. And the ultimate response to anything like that is some sort of code change that, you know, changes the rules, because people, I think in a situation like that, we would be able to agree that if we don't change the rules to, you know, get this bad actor off of the network, then the network is doomed. So I think there's always an answer, you know, to every problem in this space. It's just a question of, like, how do you come to consensus about actually moving forward?
Yep, that makes sense. And I'm just curious, like, what's your thought on proof of stake? And do you see, like, what are the advantages and disadvantages? And should, like, someone in the Bitcoin community also think about working on proof of stake?
Yeah, so, well, even, you know, proof of stake is tricky because there are a ton of different variations on proof of stake. But if we're just talking about, okay, you own a certain number of tokens in a system, and then you can basically use those tokens to be like an authority that, you know, puts them up at risk. And as a result, you are saying, you know, these transactions and blocks on the network are valid. And if everyone disagrees with you, then you lose your coins. First of all, that's a very different security model than proof of work, because you're using value inside of the system to secure itself. Whereas proof of work uses resources and value that are external to the system to secure the system. You can then, it starts to become almost more philosophical then about, does that mean that it is more fair or more competitive when it's external resources, because that means that anyone theoretically can go and, you know, get electricity and build hardware that they then add to a proof of work system to compete with the existing proof of work participants. Whereas if you want to compete in a proof of stake system, you actually have to go and buy out the existing token holders. So it kind of creates a model where the people that are already in the system have a lot more power. It's harder, you know, it's harder to compete with them because you actually basically have to buy them out. You have to, you know, put more money into the system itself to get more of those tokens in order to compete. So the even Vitalik Buterin has referenced the quote unquote nobility problem within proof of stake systems. And I'm not so sure that there's really like a solution for that, but some people may not consider it to be a huge problem.
Yep, got it. And like, so we are talking about proof of stake and you talked about Vitalik. And how do you see other altcoins and other projects as well? Do you see that, say we have Monero and Zcash, Decred, they are working on some specific problems. We have Ethereum, which is building like a smart computer or a world computer, which you can run smart contracts. And we have ton of other ERC-20 projects. So how do you view the space? And do you feel that in the long run that these projects will add actual value to the crypto ecosystem?
In general, I think the projects that have a more narrow focus are probably more likely to achieve their goals. You know, one of the things with like Ethereum being this general purpose computer is that I don't think that it's going to be able to do everything for everyone. I don't think, you know, anything can be everything to everyone. And so, you know, as a result, it's, you know, kind of finding its own identity. You know, over the past year or so, Ethereum basically became an ICO generator. You know, what will it become next? I don't know. It's, you know, I think what any of these systems are going to be, they are going to facilitate whatever actions are of the greatest economic value to the people using the system. So, you know, I think there's a reason why ICOs became so popular. It's because they brought a ton of money into the system. You know, while, you know, stuff like CryptoKitties was, you know, popular for a little while, it's not something that's ongoing because, you know, this is a resource constrained system. And if CryptoKitties are fighting for block space resources and CPU and gas resources against ICOs that are pulling in tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars, then obviously the people that are generating many, many, many millions of dollars are going to be willing to pay more for the resources on the system. And they are essentially going to, you know, price out the less economically valuable interactions on the system. So yeah, I mean, I think that a number of these projects will continue to be successful. Like I said, I'm most interested in the privacy projects. Those are also very narrowly focused, so it's a lot easier to judge, you know, whether or not they have been successful at achieving their goals. But then these more, you know, general projects that are trying to do all kinds of stuff, it's a lot harder to judge, I guess, how well they're able to achieve, you know, the goal of, you know, being a generic world computer. So my, like, with regard to Ethereum in general, my kind of thesis is that value has been shown that, you know, it's valuable to have this Ethereum virtual machine, you know, this developer-friendly scripting smart contract-esque language. What is less clear is whether or not Ethereum will succeed more as a general protocol and scripting language or as a main network itself. And what I mean by that is that the EVM has been adopted by a number of other projects. Hyperledger, RSK, and I think a few other like private blockchains, for example, because it's valuable. And I can see that continuing to happen. But just due to like the scalability issues in general, it may be that, you know, the protocol itself becomes more widely adopted because you can then have, you know, 1,000 different networks out there that are running Ethereum compatible stuff. whereas the main network may or may not be able to eventually scale up to process everything that everyone wants it to do.
Mm-hmm. Got it. And like when you work with Casa, you deal with a lot of institutional clients and high net worth individuals. How do they see these coins? Because what I've observed is like people who got into crypto in like 2017 or 2018, they actually are believers of ERC20 tokens and Ethereum. And it's very hard to tell everyone like about Bitcoin maximalism and like why Bitcoin will succeed in the long term. So do you feel that what sort of response are you getting from high net worth individuals? And do you see that like, say, hedge funds or institutional people who are wanting to create this sort of portfolio, they would buy into these shit coins?
Well, yeah, I mean, you can't really categorize everyone into, you know, one single bucket, because there's a diversity of different people in the space. And you know, at Casa, we are a Bitcoin first company. We do want to help people just secure their private keys in general for anything that is valuable. But you know, we've even had issues with Ethereum and, you know, their multi-sig functionality or lack thereof, where, you know, we're trying to basically get some consensus around a standard for multi-sig on Ethereum, so that we can actually integrate that into our product. But yeah, I mean, when you start talking about people that are more focused just on the investment aspects and they want to invest in this ecosystem as much as possible, then yeah, you also run into folks that are more along the like almost index fund style stuff of like, you know, I want to invest a little bit in everything and hope that I find that next the next Bitcoin, you know, ride the bubble basically. But in my experience, like the folks who are what I would consider to be like extremely experienced crypto investors tend to come at it from the mindset of, yeah, I'm investing in these other things, but I'm doing it because I want to end up with more Bitcoins. So it's really just a psychological thing, right? Is that they're trying to get in before other people get interested, and then they want to get out before the interest wanes.
Right. A lot of these pumps and dumps are essentially that, you know, people are just trying to steal Bitcoin from folks who have no idea what they're getting into, and they just end up sitting on a bag of a shitcoin. Anyway, okay. So one of my other questions is, so like TCP, right? HTTP is built on TCP, right? And TCP was never built with the privacy in mind, right? And now 30, 40 years down the line, we are seeing this gigantic internet in front of us, which has like no layer of privacy inbuilt. And then there are these corporations, pretty much like data thug corporations, who are stealing data from every place that they can. And they're trying to sell the data, work with the governments, and then try to make money off of it and like help their spying buddies and whatnot, right? So do you think we are at a verge, as humanity, we are at a cusp of like building a protocol where we have like privacy as the number one thing, and then everything else is built on top, where you don't need voter IDs, you don't need driver license IDs, you just have a pseudonymous identity, and like that's like reviewed wherever you go, and like based on that you get all the services. Do you think we are heading in that direction, or do you think that's just like a utopia?
It's certainly more utopistic and very long-term view right now, because, you know, the fundamental problem is that you have to get buy-in. You have to have, you know, enough inertia for those type of systems to gain value, because you're essentially you're recreating, you know, these existing networks from scratch. And so in the vast majority of cases, we're talking about recreating what is essentially, you know, government-controlled networks. And so how do you do that, you know, without some sort of violent overthrow of the government? I think that means it's going to have to be a much more longer, natural, organic process, where these distributed networks build up reputation over years and decades and generations, and that eventually it just becomes a no-brainer that governments end up using these, much like how, you know, governments are now providing a lot of services through online websites, right? It needs to become a mature technology that people trust due to its history and longstanding reputation of being trustworthy.
Right. Okay. So, but you foresee, like, let's say 100 years down the line, there are definitely going to be like governments that are falling just because they can't print any more money and their coin is a shit coin in itself. And people like start like trading their goods and services in Bitcoin or let's say any other coin that becomes number one.
Yeah. Well, I mean, ultimately what I want to see is to create more free markets where you know, to take Bitcoin as an example, we're finally creating a free market money where governments have never really had to compete with regard to money before. They just dictated how the money worked and the citizens had to do it. But just by simply having competition in the first place, I think will force governments to provide better services. And, you know, whether or not that means that the governments or some of them or all of them will, you know, collapse and fail, or maybe it just means that they will become better. This is kind of like the thesis of the sovereign individual, right? Is that by forcing governments to compete more, they will continue to exist and offer services, but they will have to offer even better incentives and services to try to get people to want to be the citizen of that government.
Right, and so do you think we are like heading towards a regime where everything is a transaction fee and there are essentially no taxes, right? Because like in India, from an entrepreneur standpoint, there's like a 35% corporate tax, and then you give dividends or you give salaries to the employees and they pay another 20 to 30% tax. And then there's the 18% GST on top of it. And then you pay tax on any road that you cross and like what not. So you're essentially paying 50 to 70% of your income in taxes in India.
Yeah.
Where you're getting a service pretty much similar to a government in Nigeria. So like, I can't like not pay my taxes, right? So do you think like, are we like heading in a direction where we are going away from a tax regime and more of a transaction fee regime?
Well, that's also where I guess privacy would come in, right? Is having the deniability. You know, if the government can't trace all of the transactions, then they can't tax it. Because, you know, and ultimately, you know, the ways that governments operate is almost entirely through fear. It's not actually through actual enforcement, because governments, they seem really powerful because they concentrate a lot of power, but they are actually have very little power in comparison to the entire citizenry in general. It's not possible for a government to throw all of the citizens in jail, for example, if all of the citizens of a country decided that a certain law should no longer be a law and they just stop obeying that law, then the government can't actually, you know, punish everyone. From that standpoint, you know, the more like natural organic governance of whatever the consensus of a population is, I think, is more important. But of course, you know, the fear and the monopoly on violence is where they're able to coerce a lot of people into doing whatever they think is best. But certain is that stuff is going to change, and you know, technology continues to evolve and accelerate, and you know, we can only make general guesses at the direction that it seems to be going in. But the reason why a lot of us think that governments may be doomed is because historically, you know, they're so bureaucratic and so slow to react to things that it seems inevitable that technology is going to outpace the ability for them to just keep up with.
Got it. Yeah, I think that's an interesting perspective on like how Bitcoin and governments would, how things can happen. And I'd like to close this talk by talking about stable coins because they are the current news topic. And so what do you see about the current stablecoin space, and do you see that like Bitcoin has been moving in the 6,500 ish range? Do you feel that we need stablecoins? What sort of purpose do you see they will serve eventually in the future? And I'd like to particularly ask about DAI as well. which is sort of like an open sourced stable coin, which runs on a particular set of code that people can see.
So is DAI the one on Ethereum?
Yep. Maker.
Yeah, that's the Maker platform.
MakerDAO.
Yeah. I mean, personally, I don't see a need for stable coins. Like, if you're trying to escape the volatility of Bitcoin, then you can, you know, use fiat. I guess it's more like having a fiat that you can then transfer on your own. You know, have some of the properties of a crypto asset that is like public and permissionless. But I don't know why you would want to hold on to a stable coin for a long period of time. It seems to be make more sense to maybe use as a transfer of value mechanism for short periods of time. So there's also just the fact that, you know, stable is such a loaded and relative term. You know, nothing is actually stable. It's all relative to something else. And over the long term, you know, these things are pegging themselves to the dollar usually. And over the long term, the dollar is going to go down in value. I mean, that's inflation. Like, that's one of the fundamental reasons why this whole ecosystem got started in the first place. So, you know, I think, you know, it's great that people have the freedom to build their stable coins and offer them as products, but that, you know, a lot of them are flawed and they're going to fail for various reasons. You know, even DAI, I guess, on Ethereum, that seems to be doing reasonably well from a volatility standpoint. But once again, you're building it on top of Ethereum, and the Ethereum network has been like constantly congested for, I want to say almost an entire year, if not longer at this point. So, you know, I'm not sure how much of great like adoption it's going to be able to get, because it's on a kind of shaky, you know, technological platform there.
Got it. I'd like to close off by just talking about the Bitcoin price. What do you think will trigger the next bull run for Bitcoin? Or do you see that we'll have this, like, say, a bear market for 1-2 years and then a bull run? Or do you see a steady growth happening? Or any thoughts you have on the price?
I mean, the only real thoughts I have are that you can't predict it, and okay. That if I'm remembering this correctly, like, historically, what tends to happen with price is that it'll be, you know, fairly stable for a while, but that most of the volatility happens within like 10 different days, I want to say, out of the year will be the vast majority of volatility. So like when it shoots up or it crashes down, these events tend to happen very quickly and you can't predict them. And so, you know, that's why, yeah, sure, we've been stable for like a week or a few months now, but at any time it could shoot up or it could crash down and, you know, then sort of set a new price level for a little while. So, you know, I try not to focus too much on it, but it definitely feels, you know, I've been through like 3 or 4 of these boom and bust cycles now. And this definitely feels like it's the like slow creeping along until something big is going to happen. So how long is that going to be? I seriously doubt it's going to be a 2-year bear market simply because we're so much larger than we were before the last 2-year bear market. There's so much more going on behind the scenes. And I think we're going to continue to see big news coming out to like large players like Fidelity, for example. There's a number of other large players that have been running Skunkworks projects for a few years now. I think those are going to start to come out into production use, and that's when we'll see, you know, more mainstream adoption happening.
Yep, got it. Yep. Yeah, Jameson, it was great talking to you. I and Vishal, we learned a lot. And yeah, I hope that you like keep posting and keep contributing to the community with the passion you have, and you maintain that passion for a long time. And thanks for taking the time.
Really appreciate it.
Yep.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Take care. Bye.
Bye.